Woohoo!
Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday!
It's Tuesday!
And it's an extra special day, David, because we are syncing our rest days together. We're officially rest day buddies.
That's so cool. It's like a lot like what they say that sometimes women sync their schedules like around the moon and everything with their menstrual cycle. We're doing it with our chill time.
That's true. And I feel like it's governed by chocolate chip cookies because this morning I had the great idea. I was like, you know, I'm going to have a chocolate chip cookie before we record this podcast. Yeah. And someone had already been there. And I know because you don't usually eat full cookies. It's a little strange. You'll eat like 2.5 cookies, but you'll never eat 2 or 3 one. Yeah. There's always a half involved.
Fractions don't count. That's my general philosophy on everything. Like if I break up the chips, then the half chips don't count as chips. Like I can eat an entire bag of chips and not have it count in my head at all. It'll be a lot very relevant to our calorie counting discussion later.
Well, why are you counting in general?
That's the thing. I don't want to count. And if it's broken up, I can't count. So usually with cookies and whatever, I'll always have like 2.5 because that it's just all bonus. It's just total. It doesn't, like, my body doesn't even consider it.
Well, you leave evidence everywhere you go. If those were a forensic examination around their house, I'd be like, David's been here and here and here. It'd be like the cookie jar, the potato chip bags, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's probably a relic of some disordered thoughts around food from the old days. Like, I'm making light of it. But, you know, I used to do this mental calculus on the number of calories I was getting inadvertently. I think a lot of people do this if you've ever been a part of diet culture in your own way, right? Like I did all that stuff when I was trying to, you know, lose weight unnecessarily and things like that when I was really young. And as a result, though, my brain has a tendency to keep wanting to do calculus. And the way to break the calculus is to make sure there's like too many variables to count. That's like basically that. My approach.
Just throw potato chip bags at it.
Yeah,
it's great.
Throw potato chips at every problem, which might be the big conclusion of our 3-year anniversary celebration for this podcast, Megan.
Happy 3-year anniversary. Yeah. This is exciting. We've been doing it a long time.
Yeah, this is episode 157. I believe like 156 is 52 times 3. So we're around there. It's somewhere in that general vicinity.
Look at your math. You are counting. I guess this goes to show the difference between us. Like I love math and I love counting, but I never know what podcast episode we're on.
I think you have a much more healthy approach to the podcast in general. You're just like, I'm just going to show up and let things flow. And I'm like looking at stats and talking about marketing and all this stuff. But I think that that really plays off well each other. So I just want to say, I love you. It's so cool that we're here. And thank you to all the listeners for helping us get to this point.
It's been a wild ride. Yeah. Thanks for sticking with us. Yeah. It's kind of shocking. Every time we record an episode, I'm like, why are people listening to this? It's a little bit horrifying in my mind.
Oh, I think it makes sense. I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts. You don't listen to many podcasts.
That's true. And the ones that I listen to are heavily produced. Yeah. And then you go to listen to ours and it's not produced at all. And it's a little bit jarring.
What are you talking about, Megan? I just bring in some magical editing skills over here. Sometimes even like edit out a cough just occasionally. It's pretty impressive.
By magical editing skills, we have an editing thing in our software that's just called, isn't it called like magical fairy dust or something like that? And it's some sort of AI voice editing that makes us sound just slightly better.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. But I like to take more credit than just letting the AI do it for me. But yeah, I listen to a lot of podcasts. And whenever I do, I'm like, you know, basically all I want in my life is to hang out with some people I like.
And that's kind of like us.
Yeah.
You're hanging out with us on a rest day.
Yeah.
We're going to the hot tub after this. We have a formal hot tub date on our rest day. I'm so excited. Rest day friends.
I'm going to be using it as heat acclimation, actually. So
you're training.
You'll probably stay in for 15 minutes, right? And that will be a sensual time where we'll bond and like mingle our fluids and stuff.
Mingle our fluids.
Well, because you can't
We're rest day friends with benefits?
No, benefits are involved. This is training. I just mean that like your fluids can't help but come out in the hot tub. Something you shouldn't think about too much when you use other people's hot tubs. But then I'm going to stay in for another 15 more minutes to get my heat up.
30 minutes in the hot tub?
Yeah.
I should really make you sign a waiver. That's a long time, man.
I need to get my blood volume gains on.
That's a little scary long.
Yeah. So after this podcast, after you listen, just imagine that you're entering the hot tub with us, and which is kind of the vibes I hope we go for. So what have you learned over the course of 3 years?
It's been so much fun. I think I've learned, it's been really fun to just like keep living life and being curious. I went to the ACSM conference this week. We're going to talk about some of those studies. And I used to dread going to conferences. Yeah. I'm like such an introvert at heart. But now I'm like, this is material. I got to take notes. I have an agenda. So it's been really fun to be curious. But I think also for me, sometimes I struggle on podcasts. Last week, it was just hard to record. And I got my period 24 hours later. And I was like, oh, I am vindicated. This is why.
See, the period thing is actually interesting to me because, you know, I see that a lot in logs too. Like there's something to the stereotype where every so often I'll see an update in a training log and I'll kind of want to ask like, hey, just to note, you noted your period 29 days ago or whatever, or whatever the exact number is. I'll want to say that, but I'll be like, no, probably shouldn't say that as a male coach. But, you know, with you in the podcast last week, it seemed like your brain was a little bit taking things more seriously than it sometimes does.
It was wired a little bit more towards self-judgment. And yeah. That hasn't been like the way that I classically experience periods, but postpartum, it's been wild. I'll have like 3 hours where I'm crying during my period, and that never happened. I'm accumulating more crying time than I have in my last 32 years of my life. Actually,
you don't really cry that much though, to be honest. Like,
that's actually true. Yeah.
What you do is like, you just kind of brood, and your life force is so strong that I feel like this gravitational pull into a black hole, just like orbiting around you. It's like, you're able to go through the motions, but the whole time I'm just like, dude, she is going to go crazy. Like that basketball coach, Bobby Knight, that threw the chair at their player. That's kind of how I feel recording a podcast with you.
Do you know how good that feels though? Like the metaphor.
Throwing of the chair or the brooding?
The throwing of the chair.
Oh, yeah,
whether
yeah.
that's like metaphorical or literal, it feels very, very good. But no, I mean, I think in that process, I've learned that self-judgment for me is the hardest part of being creative. And when I'm with you, it needs to be flow state. Like I have to turn off that self-judgment. I can worry after the fact.
Definitely.
We can edit out a heinous joke that I've made that might or may not get me canceled. Yeah. And if you ever hear an awkward edit, it's probably because we made a heinous joke. It's the only time besides magical fairy dust that we ever do edits.
Oh no, I make heinous jokes too. But the thing to remember is we're at episode 157 right now.
We haven't gone canceled yet.
Yeah. And what happened at episode 111?
I don't know.
I don't know shit. I don't know what happened at episode 156, which is so liberating. If you're out there, put yourself just in the public eye or whatever it is that makes you vulnerable, and don't worry about it too much. Everything is kind of in one ear, out the other. We hope we can give you vibes, maybe a little bit of learning, maybe a little bit of love. But everything else, like, I think the self-judgment often comes from a place of, it's not that serious, you know?
Yeah. And for me, I've learned that vulnerability lasts 2 days at max, plus or minus 1 day.
Yeah.
It depends. And then it all gets better from there. And then we record the next week and I forget about what was in episode 111.
Yeah. I love that. And then everything is content, baby.
That's true. Yeah.
It encourages you to live your life. I've always heard stand-up comedians say the key in not like losing your act is to keep being a person, right? And that's why sometimes as comedians get into their 40s and 50s, they start to get these really calcified views of like social issues. They can get really weird.
Well, they need to exchange fluids in a hot tub. Those calcified issues. Well, that's how you break down calcifications.
I think they're doing probably a lot of that fluid exchange, but not with people that are calling them on their shit.
That's a good point.
You have a lot of yes people around you. You know, whereas for us, like, we hope to continue living our lives. We'll have a story in a minute that is an example of that. And then finally for me, it's like curiosity. And it's something I've learned from you, and I'm so gracious to you for teaching me this. It's like, you're the top expert in this world in so many,
no.
but in so many ways, but you're always open to hearing from everyone, no matter what their background is. Like, someone could be a high school athlete, and if they tell you something, you're going to step up and listen to them and be like, how does this change the way I think about the world?
I'm going to step up and listen to them for exactly 12 and a half minutes of my time.
Yeah.
Cause I've gotten very good at setting boundaries. Before I was like, yeah, I'll listen. I'll sit here and listen to this story for an hour. And now I'm scheduled.
We're the king and queen of boundaries right now.
Oh, it's so great. You're crushing the boundaries.
I'm doing so good.
You took a whole, we talked on the last podcast that I've been kind of thinking about my work boundaries, and you in that process have done the same, because I don't think you've taken a day off of coaching in, I mean, you've worked Christmas, you worked the day Leo was born, you've worked birthdays, you've worked, I mean, every single holiday possible. And you took a day off on a random Saturday. Okay. How did that amount?
So slight complication. I did work from 5 to 7 a.m. when you were sleeping.
But it doesn't count. If I'm sleeping, it's an off day.
Yeah. Object permanence is something you're working on, much like Leo. But yeah, so after that, I didn't open my computer all day. And I think part of it, I care about coaching so much that it doesn't really feel like work. But in the process, perhaps I do let things get to me. Because like in the, just like every job, some things will be going great. But if one thing is going tough, you're going to internalize that a little bit. So I didn't open my computer at all on Saturday. I think it's the first time probably since 2014 or something.
I was so proud of you.
Yeah.
I mean, it took a lot of courage to do that. And I think it's going to get easier from here. But how did you feel mentally? Like, did you feel like there was a mental weight lifted from you?
I'm just so hashtag courageous. yeah, I kind of just made a decision after you inspired me on the podcast last week. So if you didn't hear that, please go back and listen to Megan talking, like, that I need to take similar steps for my own mental health, because I have found myself, I don't consider it work is the problem, but I have found myself working so hard at times that I lose sight. I'm always getting to the next thing. Even when I'm having fun, it's 2 hours of fun rather than just kind of like an open-ended bodily fluid exchange of fun. And so that's what I'm trying to work on right now. And it's all because of you.
Well, it's kind of permeated into the other days too. So it started on Saturday. And then this morning you were just hanging with Leo and I. You had a moment before the podcast and you're like, you know, I'm going to go take Leo outside and see if he wants to feel the grass. And I'm like, are you you high right now? What is going on? What have you exchanged in terms of fluids and substances?
Megan, those weren't just regular cookies. They had some special ingredients. No, I'm just like, I'm flowing. I'm flowing on that cosmic wavelength, baby.
It's great. I feel like it's opened your brain to creativity. Yeah. But I think for me also on this podcast, like as we talk about reflecting on the last 3 years, it's been setting up those boundaries so we can have that creative freedom.
Yeah.
But I think for me also just showing up in whatever state I am in and definitely just being, because sometimes I feel like when we get on this podcast, there feels like there's this pressure or this onus on us to be funny or to be sentimental or to be X, Y, and Z. And yeah, that's a lot when you start to stack it up. And I think sometimes when I enter that judgmental state, I'm like thinking about, oh, am I being funny enough? Yeah. Am I being engaging enough? And I finally stopped. I'm like, I'm just going to be. You know, and whatever I am in that day is good enough. And it's also an accurate reflection of what we're living.
So many people reach out and say that about you, that like your vulnerability on here has inspired them so much. And they don't do that about me as much. It's very interesting.
You're way more vulnerable than I am.
But one thing that you
You talk about your fluids a lot more than I do.
I talk about our fluids. We are a team here that shares this fluid journey. No, one thing that you never have to try to be, though, thankfully, is sexy. Oh. That's just your background state. Granted, you did say right before you got on that your armpit hair is getting quite long.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Is that sexy to you?
I love everything about you.
And that's why you're amazing. Yeah. I can just be. And you're like, those smells, those weirdnesses, that hair.
Yeah.
It's all for me.
Yeah, the unibrow hair is almost touching the mic right now.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. It truly is. Yeah.
It looks like Avatar, where they have the big things off the back of their neck that they used to like port. That's you and your unibrow. But it's so sexy to me. I love it. Oh. Okay, so the final thing I think we've learned is to take Athletic Greens. They've been the sponsor that stuck with us for the longest time, and it has been so meaningful. So athleticgreens.com/swap, S-W-A-P. The reason that this partnership has been so productive is because we believe in it so much. I'm going to have it right when I get out of that hot tub so that it hits just right, and I can't wait.
And to be fully transparent on here too,
yeah,
when you're taking your rest day on Saturday, you're like, I can do this because we have Athletic Greens in our life.
Yeah.
And it's been actually helpful. I mean, it's been a helpful financial interest for us as definitely we reflect on these last 3 years, and it allows us to create this fun content that lets us just be, but also allowed you to take a full rest day from on work. Saturday.
I didn't take a rest day from training. I crushed my training day.
You had a great tempo.
Yeah. It was so good. So do that. And then finally, just a quick reflection on the podcast generally. It's, you know, almost every week, the top running episode in the US and Canada. Thank you. Your listening means so much. Please rate and review it. Give it 5 stars. Click follow wherever you listen, which helps other people follow find it. And most of all, just a big love letter to you all. It's just crazy that we're doing this thing 3 years later. I can't wait to be doing it 30 years from now. And so as a final reflection on the 3 years, I wanted to read a passage from a book that I think is really relevant to our mission statement here, what we're trying to do. Because what we'll have athletes or people reach out to often is say, hey, can you timestamp this podcast with various topics, especially the training ones? Mm. And I always say no, because I don't think that's what we're trying to do. Like, if we wanted to give reference materials, we could. And I think we could really step up and give great training reference materials. But I also don't think it would be as big of a podcast or something we enjoy as much if that's the approach we took. I think what we're trying to do is give the vibes of this book passage I'm about to read.
Well, we should timestamp the podcast with various words that we say on repeat. Oh. So if we did fascinating, we'd probably have 25. I say fascinating all the time.
Yeah.
We could probably have 25 different timestamps. Or this episode, I think we probably said fluids about 8 times to this point when we're about 13 minutes in.
And we're just getting started.
Yeah.
Fluids. We're going for it. We're going to set the fluid record on this episode. Okay, so this excerpt comes from Hello Molly, a memoir by Molly Shannon. Molly Shannon, for those that don't know, she was on SNL for the longest time. You might have known her character, Mary Catherine Gallagher, like superstar, all that stuff. I just spit on Megan when I said the word superstar there. I apologize.
I feel like you have to spit when you say superstar. You do. It's an obligation. Yes.
And she's an absolutely incredible person. Really recommend this memoir. As I'm opening this book, it is crumpled because I've been reading it in the sauna. And every time I read it, I have these epiphanies about my own life, which is wild coming from a memoir of, you know, a comedic actress. She's just so brilliant, and I can't wait to read this for you all.
Well, the perks of reading books in sauna is that it just stays open to the page that you like the most because the pages are all congealed together with your fluids.
Yes, exactly. This has, basically, we've had a lot of pro athletes use our sauna, actually, because, like, swap athletes will come over, use our treadmill, use our sauna, and every single time they read the books, I'm like, that's good. It's a very powerful thing that we're getting a diversity of fluids in our sauna.
Well, I feel required to tell our pro athletes that you sauna naked.
Megan, don't say that. No.
We have told them. We have been very upfront about this situation.
Okay.
They're not saunaing with you. It's just that your naked aura has been in our sauna.
Yeah. So sorry about the pink eye. Okay, so here's the quote. This is after she moved to LA, before she was famous. No one knew who she was. She's just grinding. It was tempting. I was broke. And I just thought, this is so hard. I went out for a walk and I cried, talking to God. It's taking forever. I'm still really struggling. It's just not fair. But during that walk, I suddenly had an epiphany. I thought, at least I'm out here doing what I love, pursuing what I love, trying. So many people I'd gone to college with had given up on their dreams. And a lot of people from my high school had moved back to Ohio after college and weren't really pursuing what they wanted. I thought to myself, at least I'm in LA, doing what I want. That alone is a very meaningful life. That's actually a good, brave thing, I thought. You're doing more than most people will ever do. I don't care if I keep trying until I'm 60. I'm going to try till I'm a grandmother, and I'm just going to enjoy the process. Yes, it's hard, but at least I'm out here doing what I want. That's a very good thing that most people aren't even brave enough to do. So what we want to celebrate here is the bravery to just do your own thing.
Can you follow up? There was another paragraph that you read me earlier that was so powerful. And sorry, I'm putting you on the spot.
Oh, no,
I have to
go
through the sauna pages to find this. But there's an additional follow-up to that that I think adds this and makes it even more powerful.
Well, I want to if you're going to want me to read more, I thought you might think that was a little too much reading.
It was not. Your reading is excellent.
Thank you. I'm stepping up today. Yeah. So now, 30 years later, that's still my spiritual and business philosophy. Struggle itself is meaningful. You never know where anything is going to go. You don't know. I didn't know if I would ever make it. But I have a positive attitude, and I think people always see that in me. And I still pursue show business the same way. And then a little bit later on, the part Megan was talking about, I've seen people who are superstar movie stars who still feel like they are only as good as their last movie, and they are full of fear and insecurity. And I think, wait a minute, you are scared? Well, in that case, I better just enjoy where I am, because if you're scared, then we are all fucked.
That's such a great passage. That was my favorite part. We're all fucked.
We're all fucked. And at this point, we're all on this journey together, every single person. And as we talk about athletics here, a key reflection is just to understand that, like, the people that are winning world championships or truly achieve their potential are dealing with the same shit that the beginner runner is dealing with. It feels the same struggles. And that's why running can be a metaphor for the types of things you want to do as a person generally. And that's where running becomes really meaningful, rather than trying to run the fastest time you can. Because, like, you're going to find that when you do that, you're only going to have with you what you took with you along the way.
And to me, that's like a warm consensual hug.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we're all going through
a consensual hug.
You know, sometimes hugs are, I'm a hugger. I'm a big time hugger. And at the conference, I started to hug a little less because I was you know, maybe this is awkward. Maybe I should tone that down a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you ever had someone go in for a hug and you're just like, ooh, I don't know.
I mean, have you seen me recently? Like, I never hug unless I ask the person first.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like hug, no hug.
Well, I feel like from coming from a guy, that makes a little bit more sense, but I'm like, yeah, maybe I should dial this back a little bit. The best hugs are consensual hugs.
I do think fist bumps, the COVID fist bumps, it should be the kind of general approach to things.
Oh, that's good stuff. Leo's starting to learn that.
Yeah. The fist bump?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's stepping up and keeping it consensual.
Yes. Yeah. But anyways, I do feel like that's a warm consensual hug.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I do feel like, to me, we're all going through these journeys. And as a coach, you get to see that play out time and time again.
Yeah.
And it only took me 2 months of coaching to realize this was a pattern recognition loop that I was seeing. And it helped me so much as an athlete myself.
Yeah. And so that's what to remember. The self-judgment cycles that Megan was talking about with the podcast, the reason we're talking about this is because it's the same exact thing that applies to your athletics. You know, we try to give you principles about training philosophy, but what we're really trying to give you is a little bit of a warm hug to understand that even as you're trying to optimize and give meaning to your day-to-day life, what really matters is, you know, can you find the joy in that grind, in the struggle that Molly talks about?
And I think what I've realized in my own life is that oftentimes I do best when something is like fourth or fifth on the priority list.
Interesting.
So whatever is number one, actually, I just put so much pressure and so much judgment on that the sweet spot is really being number four or number five.
Yeah.
But how do it's important to care about a lot of things. So how do I kind of mentally move things down so that everything is just number four or number five on the list?
Why? Why would you do that though? Because, like, can't you just change your approach?
That's what I'm saying. Is that
can it be number one? Does it become number one? If everything's number four or five, does it all become number one?
It's all number one. Yeah, I like that. But I mean, there's like five or six things at number one. Yeah.
What I've seen a really big evolution in you, though, is that you're less afraid to be clear about your goals.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting with training because you deal with a health context where you're probably going to have major issues ahead. Like, you've been very lucky since birth, and maybe this is the new normal, is you're back to what you felt like in 2016. But, like, I've seen you getting vulnerable again in ways that I haven't seen for a long time. I mean, is that something that's intentional, or are you going to keep doing that?
Oh yeah, it's fully intentional. It's intentional with the idea that I'm probably going to hit 20% of those goals. Yeah. Like we said on the podcast that I was going to do Speed Goat 50K. Yeah, that shit's not happening. That's a lot of vert on my postpartum pelvis. I did like 3,000 or 4,000 feet of vert in training, and I was like, nope, not going to happen. I'm going to get a pelvic stress fracture doing that postpartum.
The pelvis tapped out on
yeah.
that one?
Yeah, pelvis was like, yeah, no.
Yeah, but the meaningful thing came from dreaming, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'll keep dreaming, and I'll just iterate off that, and you know what happens. Yeah.
And one thing I try to say to almost everyone that reaches out in the context of what I'm saying to them, probably a lot of you out there have gotten this type of email from me, is in the context of it, I will say dream so big. Mm-hmm. And so as we reflect on this, you know, 3 years in the past, 30 years in the future, dream so big. Even if your life is like not going to be a movie star like Molly, even if you're just living your day-to-day life, choose something that's so big and scary that it requires you to dream each day, because it really adds so much flavor to every single experience you have.
It's the umami. As a final podcast wrap up though, as on this like discussion, do you have big podcast dreams? We haven't really talked about this in terms of where this is going in 5, 10, 20 years.
I just want to be here with you every day.
Yeah, that's me too.
You know,
yeah.
For me, actually showing up is super hard. And I do like want it to just be one of the main things we do, which has happened. And I never would have dreamed that. And once we did start letting ourselves open up to that possibility, it's become huge. Like, I mean, I could see in the future that the podcast and media stuff is like our main outlet, you know, if we dial back coaching when Leo's like in his teen years or something, because we're coaching his teams. So
I love that. Yeah. Just showing up with
you. Do you have any big dreams?
No, that's exactly it. I mean, it is hard. And I think that's the idea of acknowledging that doing this week after week is hard. And it's also fucking amazing at the same time. So that's my dream in 5 to 10 years, is just to keep doing it.
Yeah.
And keep it the same. Keep it groovy.
Keep it fluidy. So if you're out there, dream so fucking big. Write it down right now and apply it to something, especially outside of athletics. Okay. Let's do a roadmap for today. We have such a cool topic with tons of science hitters. We are going to talk about the American College of Sports Medicine, a bunch of different studies from that. Psychological factors of performance and coaching. Iron timing. Interesting recent study on iron and mental health, menstrual cycle studies, a lot of fun, random things, world championships, possibly talking about short distance racing. We didn't get to it last week. And finally finishing up with hot takes.
I'm so excited about all this. I was taking diligent notes at ACSM last week, which is the conference that supplied a lot of this research. But how I was doing it was I was just taking pictures of different PowerPoint slides. So I have like people's heads. Sometimes they would flip the PowerPoint slide right as I was taking a picture and I'd let out an audible fuck.
Yeah.
So it was a really fun conference of data gathering.
Could you imagine if I was sitting in front of you?
We would have so much fun. I want to go to a conference with you.
Oh no, I was thinking more if you were taking pictures and you got the back of my head.
Yeah, because you cut your own hair and the back of your head is like a zigzaggy buzzsaw. But you know what? I love it. It's like my armpit hairs. I uplift it.
But I also, my head, it's like pubes, my hair.
That's true.
It's really rough and it's super, you know, all over the place.
It's like a Brillo pad.
Yeah. It's actually a pretty big source of concern. The other day a few weeks ago, I really down on my appearance.
Did you really? I get like that sometimes.
Yeah. It's just like, I looked at my hair and I'm like, why? Why is it like that?
Anytime you feel like that, just come talk to me.
I will.
In the hot tub.
Okay,
we'll solve it.
Yeah, I can just rub my head against the counter to clean off any breakdown messes, and that'll make me feel useful at least.
Oh, it'll be so sexy. You're cleaning our house. Yeah. There's nothing sexier than cleaning a house.
Than a man who cooks and cleans. Okay, so on ACSM, on the very final day for you, you went out to your car, which was parked in downtown Denver, and what happened?
It was gone.
It was gone!
And you know what? I thought to myself, I have fucked up.
Yeah.
Because I have fucked up a lot of times and gotten our car towed, or got in our car in various situations, or like parked in the wrong spot or something like that. And I was like, oh, Megan.
You're good at a lot of things. You're not good at paperwork.
I'm not good at logistics. I'm not good at parking my car. I'm not good at updating my car registration.
You're good at the activity of parking.
No, I actually can't parallel park.
Okay, I didn't want to call you out on that, Megan.
And that's embarrassing.
It's okay.
I failed my driver's test as a kid because
okay.
I couldn't parallel park. I had this big, we had the Nissan Xterra, which was a huge, clunky, environmentally shitty car.
Yeah.
And I couldn't parallel park it. And so to this day, I just saw that. I like somehow passed my driver's test by doing a clunky parallel park.
Yeah.
But I've never done it since.
Ever
in my life.
Megan,
I will drive around a city block for like 15 loops before I parallel park.
You have no idea how much you probably are helping a lot of listeners of the podcast that are sharing the same secret, but can't say anything about it.
Well, I felt a lot of shame about it because my dad tried to teach me to parallel park and he just, quite frankly, I love my dad. He was a horrible teacher. It wasn't just my fault. It was his fault. He was really bad at teaching this. And I just became embarrassed about it. And then I failed my test, which is like the only test I've ever failed.
And then it gets in your head.
Then it got in my head. And then why do we need to parallel park? It's actually, I haven't really thought about it until this moment on the podcast. I just don't do it.
I like it. You just perpendicular park where you just go up on the sidewalk.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So you get out to your car, you're looking for it. It's not there. What happens next?
So I call, I'm like, surely it's towed. So I call the tow company, which is listed on the parking lot. It was like a 20 car parking lot. So
it cost a $45 to
$45.
Park there.
So of course I walked around it. I also walked around it like 25 times being like, well, maybe my car is somewhere else. Maybe I like parked it in the wrong spot. So then I just sat there and I DoorDash pizza and I just sat there and I ate it in the parking lot while I was going to figure out what to do.
Just looking for epiphanies. Kind of like when Newton was under the apple tree, just ruminating on gravity. You were there ruminating on pizza.
Pizza solves all problems. I was in such a better mood. I was like, you know, say lovey. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. So I called the tow company and they're like, we don't tow from this lot. And I was like, oh, okay. I might be vindicated again. This is good. So then I called the police and as I was explaining to this story to them, I was like, you know, I must have done something wrong. Yeah. Like, clearly I have done something wrong. And they're like, no, ma'am, your car is stolen. And it, in fact, is stolen because it's about 5 days later and we still don't have it back.
Best news of all this is how happy you were. I talked to you. You've never been more happy than when you found out you didn't fuck something up. Because you locked the car. You took the only key. There was no glass breaking. This was in broad daylight in downtown Denver. And you were just like, you know what? I'm not a shithead. Go me.
I also feel like I very rarely lock the car. Yeah. Like our car outside our house is probably pretty rarely locked. But when I got to downtown Denver, I was actually a little uncomfortable in this parking lot.
Yeah.
So I'd been in this parking lot the night before at 10 p.m. and I felt like someone was watching me, which is a strange thing. I mean, as a woman, sometimes you feel like that a lot.
Definitely.
But as a result, I locked the car and heard the physical sound. And I walked back 8 steps and pulled the handle and I was like, okay, it's locked. Yeah. And then I walked into the conference, which I never do.
And it's a car with a physical key.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have some car thieves out there that have figured out how to steal 2018 Subaru Crosstrek without any breaking and entering and without a key.
They're geniuses.
That's the thing I wanted to reflect on. I am so inspired by these thieves. Like, think of the things we've said we want to dream big on. They dreamed big that they could steal a Subaru Crosstrek without any benefits.
In the broad daylight.
And they did it.
I was so curious by this. I went down a full Google rabbit hole. I typed in, how do you steal a car?
Yeah.
And I spent about 45 minutes looking this up, and it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
I'm just, in anything you do, imagine these car thieves and be like, you know what? I want to be like them just a little bit.
Well, I was imagining. So we have a swap sticker in the back of our car. It's our very cute T-Rex logo. Yeah. And every time I'm in traffic and cut someone off, which happens sometimes, I feel really bad. Yeah. I feel like the swap T-Rex logo is watching down on me. And I'm like with this like layer of like, oh shoot, I'm letting down our swap T-Rex. But I imagine right now our swap T-Rex is on a journey.
Yeah. It's going on an adventure.
It's probably dealing crack.
So we've had a lot of reflections on this and we're so excited. I mean, my main one is sometimes having a car stolen is a little bit liberating because—
I think it's a police privilege to say that. Like, you know, we were able to sort out, we have insurance, we were able to sort out a rental car for free.
We don't know anything, not for free. We're paying a pretty good amount of money for
that
rental car. We don't know anything that's going to happen. But what I was thinking of is sometimes when we've cooked like spaghetti or something and we put it back in the fridge and the Tupperware just gets way to the back and it's been there for 3 weeks and it gets moldy, I'll just take out the Tupperware and be like, fuck that, in the trash, the entire thing.
Which I have called you out. I'm like, that is wasteful. Don't do that.
Yeah, but like, you know, part of you is just like, I can't deal with this right now. And similarly, we've had this car for a while. It's pretty dirty.
Oh my God, it's covered in dog hair.
Yeah.
There's like old sweat.
Let's not say too much stuff in case the insurance company is listening.
Oh, that's true. I told our insurance company, I was like, it's in great condition.
Yeah, it is in great condition.
But I failed to say, they're like, do you have any valuables in there? I was like, nope. And then I said, two seconds later, I was like, oh, Megan, that was your chance to say we had 4 laptops in there.
But as that happened, I'm like, you know what? It's just kind of like tossing the Tupperware out. We'll hope maybe we'll get it back. Maybe it'll go on great adventures and it'll have more character when it comes back. Or maybe we'll be able to get a new car and wipe that slate clean.
I'm pretty sure it's on a great adventure. Well, at the same time this was happening, I came back into the hotel and my research coordinator, Ellie, her DoorDash had gotten stolen. Wow. And I was like, that is a tragedy. Stealing a car is a comedy.
Yeah.
Getting your dinner stolen is a tragedy. So I feel like that's where it ranks. That is way worse. If I got my DoorDash stolen, my pizza had been stolen, I would have been much sadder.
I love that reflection so much. It reminds me, I think it's like a Mel Brooks quote or something, which is, you know, it's a tragedy when I have a hangnail. It's a comedy when you fall into a sewer and die or something like that. That's kind of the reverse of that. Because it would be so, could you imagine if DoorDash got stolen off your front porch?
It happens all the time in Denver. So Denver is the car stealing capital of the world. I did not know that. Now I know that. And apparently the DoorDash stealing capital of the world too.
Wow. That breaks my heart. The car stealing stuff, like, fine. Like, it's whatever. I'm, you know, I, again, Hashtag inspired. That is cool. They need to make some TikToks that show their methods, and I will share the fuck out of those because I am impressed. But stealing pizza, that's just not cool, man.
It's not cool. Not cool at all. Not yeah. cool. You would have had 3.5 slices of those pizza.
Oh my gosh. Those evil people. Okay, let's get to some discussions about ACSM. So this is where the entire sports medicine world comes together to talk about interesting findings. Megan was there. I'd love to hear some of the takeaways you had.
So many takeaways. And actually, the beginning of our podcast discussion ties in really well with this takeaway. Yeah. So this one is on the inaccuracy of calorie counters. And we haven't really talked on this topic before, but I remember as a kid, I mean, I feel like I've had a pretty healthy relationship with food since college.
Yeah.
But I remember as a kid, the first time I stepped on a treadmill, I was like, ooh, what are these calorie counters? Definitely. On here. And I had a lot of fun like watching it stack up.
Yeah.
And I don't know where that came from, but it was like an intrinsic love of numbers. And seeing that number add up, I was like, ooh, this is fun. I'm like a hamster on a hamster wheel with an output.
And I mean, I think so much of us, when we think about metabolism, think of calories in, calories out frameworks.
Yeah, equations.
Especially if we have any history with it, right? So I'm sure you've thought about food at some point in your life before that point. We've talked about that in the podcast before. For me, like, you know, when I was in seventh grade, I went through this period where I restricted so heavily. And I did that by counting things and understanding these runner's world calculators of 1 mile at this weight is equal to these calories. And that math is still in my head in different ways, even though we've learned since it's bullshit, not just in terms of performance and low energy availability and all that, but also in terms of how you think about metabolism and how these calculations actually work.
Well, I'm grateful that my mind has been set free of these calculations. Yeah. But I think if you're struggling with this, a large part of my mind has been set free from it is I understand they're a proxy and they're a bad proxy.
Definitely.
And the science is backing this up. And this is what I loved at ACSM. So this is actually based off of a 2017 journal article in the Journal of Personalized Medicine. And recent research has expanded on this. So the article in the journal is Accuracy in Wistborn Sensor-Based Measurements of Heart Rate and Energy Expenditure in a Diverse Cohort. And what they found was that 6 of the 7 devices measured heart rate within 7%, plus or minus 7%, which is pretty good. We've talked about this here on the podcast, that in exercise, that's actually not great.
Yeah.
Because 7% is quite a bit. But when you're thinking about like measurement of calorie counting, that's okay. But 0 of those devices measured energy expenditure well.
Yeah.
And recent literature has shown that in terms of measuring energy expenditure with the calorie counters, there's only 40 to 80% accuracy in terms of measuring calories burned, which is really, really low.
And it's so wild, especially because the modern wrist-based monitors, some of them have better heart rate. Mm-hmm. Though it varies. As always, we sometimes get heart rate files of listeners that are trying to calculate their lactate threshold heart rate based on some of the podcasts we've said. And you are sending in random number generators, particularly a couple brands, their wrist-based monitors suck. But assuming that the wrist-based measurements of heart rate are relatively correct, you assume that the calorie counts would be relatively close. And the fact that they're not, I think, shows some really interesting things about metabolic processes in general and how flexible they truly are.
And it goes to show, too, that these are complicated algorithms that we're plugging it into. So the algorithm that spits out calorie counting or energy expenditure is based off of wrist movement and heart rate. And both of those are weak proxies for what's happening in the body overall in terms of energy expenditure. And I think that's fascinating. So one of the points of the study was to see if we could devise a more accurate calorie counter, which is not for the point of this podcast. The point of the podcast is to emphasize the idea that these are metrics of calorie counting. And thus you shouldn't worry about measuring energy expenditure or calories through treadmills, through devices, through these other things, because they're just purely inaccurate. So set yourself free.
Set yourself free. Be liberated from calorie counts. Like as much as you possibly can. You know, we were joking earlier about me and my approach to food, but I have consciously done that. Like I make sure I never go down the process of ever counting my calories.
By eating 7/8 of a chip, which I like.
Well,
you've devised a way to get around it.
That habit has stuck. Because 7/8 of a chip is are tastier. It's like, it's tastier to get crumbs. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Like you get more surface area, more umami all over your tongue. But, you know, I've also learned in athletics, like I just totally disregard any of that stuff because in no way is it healthy, but also in no way is that how the body works. There's some fascinating research by Herman Ponsner about how the metabolic approaches of different people really do flex over time and based on levels of activity. So if you're trying to do calculations, especially with any precision, you're already fucking up. Like, it's not how the body works. And you're essentially, your brain is trying to add precision to something that is much more general and intuitive in practice and how it actually is applied in the body.
Which I think is a really cool part of the human body. But anyway, so Scott Delp's lab actually set out to design a more accurate measure of energy expenditure. And they did so through IMUs, which are inertial measurement units. And these IMUs measure the acceleration and rotation of the leg as it's moving. So the leg, it's a better proxy. And they have one sensor on the upper part of the leg and then one on the shank. I think it's really funny when
the shank.
Whenever I have an injury, I'm like, it's my fucking shank.
Your shank.
Yes. I feel like it feels like a derogatory term for a leg, doesn't it? It's used all the time in biomechanics research. And whenever I see it, I have a good laugh.
I had no idea. That's amazing. Yeah, definitely sounding like a cut of meat is an interesting way to go through life.
I feel like you could apply that to a lot of exercise physiology research, how we talk about terms. It's just a shank.
It's just a shank.
But it's
interesting to think about applying to your leg. Like, I also think that that's probably going to be subject to a lot of uncertainties. Like, imagine someone's doing the stanky leg.
You know,
Or like the hokey pokey even.
Yeah.
It's like, you're going to get different measurements when you put that one leg in, then you take that one leg out.
Well, I think one of the key parts of it too, is it's two sensors, not one.
Yeah.
And the more sensors you add up to a certain point, add more accuracy, which makes a lot of sense when you're thinking about these models. But even this, I think they were saying that it had like 13% inaccuracy. Yeah. So it still has a large amount of inaccuracy. It's just better than the risk.
And what benefit is that even? Like, I mean, yes, there is benefit, especially in understanding low energy availability, but it points out you can liberate yourself, let the researchers dial this stuff in ways that we all give you summaries of, but don't do it yourself.
Exactly.
Unless you're working with an expert that you really trust. And that gets to a question from Patreon that is awesome. As always, patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. There we answer tons of questions. We do a bonus podcast every week. We use science corner posts that dig deep into training topics and get lots of great questions like this one. I bloody love the podcast. I listen to it while I work and it really makes the day fly by. I know you guys aren't dietitians, but was wondering what your views are on calorie counting as a way to avoid unintended underfueling. I decided to try it and was really surprised by how few calories I was eating overall. I've since bumped up my calories and my recovery and performance has dramatically improved, but I know it's not very sustainable long term. Any tips on how to avoid unintentional underfueling without tracking calories?
I love this. And I love that their intention too is to avoid underfueling. But I think the process of counting calories, even if you're trying to avoid underfueling, can still be really challenging. So I think my first recommendation, work with a registered dietitian because they can really help in this process. There's also ways they can do this without having you count.
Yeah.
So you can take pictures of your food and send it to them. You can do food diaries and it avoids the use of math.
Yeah.
We talked about last week on the podcast, the neural circuitry related to eating disorders. And a lot of that has to do with habit formation.
Yeah.
And I worry that even if your intentions are good, like in this case of trying to avoid underfueling, that even just starting that process of counting calories can become a habit over time, even if it starts with good intentions.
You know, I should have been a dietitian because people would send me photos of their food.
Oh my God, it's like food porn.
It's kind of my dream.
It's so good.
I often make athletes send me pictures of like a cheeseburger or whatever when they're tired. I'm like, you must eat a cheeseburger and you must send it to me.
And you're like, send me a picture of your foot too. Just kidding. You don't have any foot fetishes.
I don't, but like, it's kind of similar. Like how much I like the food. It's kind of like how much people like feet, which is pretty wild how much people like feet. There's an entire website that has like every person's foot on it and like rates it. But no, like I think that understanding that, you know, this type of counting is probably not super helpful is important because there is a place for initial calibration to have a general feel.
I do really broad calculations of how much protein I get in. And it's on the magnitude of like tens or twenties in terms of how I'm counting it and adding it up. Because for me, the really precise measurements just don't work for me.
Yeah. But then once you get a general idea that like, okay, I'm having, you know, you shouldn't be having 2000 calories a day if you're training, like that's too few. As long as you're like, you know, up in those higher numbers, like 3000, 4000, whatever that number is for you while you're training, you're fine within general range. Because I think sometimes people then are like, oh, well, did I underfuel by 200 calories today? Or did I overfuel by a certain number? And that's not the way to view it. So for this athlete, like, yes, make sure you're eating enough, but then try to just plug it into your intuition. And it's a lot like monitoring your heart rate during running in that regard. Like, it's good to have a general feel for where your zones lie, but you shouldn't be staring at your heart rate monitor to determine your feel. It should be just an initial spot check and a periodic, you know, like recheck to make sure you're not totally fucking off.
I love that analogy. That's perfect. That's kind of how we approach it is I like doing spot checks on protein, making sure I'm getting enough calories. I have no concept.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea how many calories I eat per day. But I think that like initial light calibration, especially with things like protein, can be helpful if you have a healthy relationship with food.
And so getting to how to avoid unintentional underfueling, the intuitive things to look at, first, fuel the work you're doing. Even though we're not talking about calories burned, you do need to understand that, like, yes, if you do a long run that day, you're probably going to need to eat more than your base metabolic rate mm-hmm. might be if you're resting. And that's a really complicated conversation to have. It's best to have with an expert. But it's the important point here. Often when athletes reach out and it's like, oh, you know, I eat it. I've just focused on eating as much as I can all the time. And I've gained, like, you know, or my blood pressure's bad or something like that. It's like, oh, well, there's still an element there where you need to understand your body intuitively and understand what it actually needs, which involves some of these general understandings, but avoiding, like, making it too precise.
And I think at the same time too, waking up hungry in the middle of the night is one of those signs that you're just not getting in enough. Actually, sometimes I've noticed you made a delicious soup last night. You've been on a cooking and cleaning roll. I'm so proud of you. But sometimes when I have soup, I wake up in the middle of the night hungry, which I think is a sign that I get full from the soup in a way that doesn't support my broader energy context. But you did too. And you stole our bar that we had hanging out in the middle of the night. And I was like, damn, man, I needed that Clif Bar.
I'm the one that feeds Leo in the middle of the night now.
Yeah.
So I deserve the bar.
You deserve the bar. That's true.
My energy expenditure's higher.
But neither of us should be having the bar in the middle of the night.
But Megan, to be fair, no, I just do it for fun.
Yeah, I was hungry.
I mean, I you shouldn't be, because the amount of oil I put in that soup, I glugged so much olive oil in that soup, it's kind of insane. Actually, another tip with soup, just use bone broth for the broth.
Like, it
tastes
great.
Incredible. It tastes rich and it gives you a lot of extra protein. It's pretty freaking great. I gotta say, my soup game is strong. You couldn't have been hungrier. Megan, the amount of cheese you put into that soup was almost horrifying. Like, it bordered on obscene, actually. I think you used an entire thing of Colby cheese, like an entire thing of shredded cheese.
I just wanted soup with my cheese. Yeah. That's basically the way I design meals, is whatever, it's blank with cheese.
You saved a little bit, like there's just a little bit of broth left at the end. And I was like, oh, just broth, I'll drink it. And I drank it and there was like a block.
It was a choking hazard.
Yeah, there was a block of congealed cheese at the bottom.
Yes,
it was incredible. And then monitor general health. Like, your health is giving you signals about this.
Yep.
You know, always work with experts, but you know, just be careful not to let yourself create neural patterns that will be incredibly negative. And also, you'll be drawing correlations without underlying causation in ways that might make you a way worse athlete over time.
That's so great. Do you want to move on to the next topic?
Let's do it.
I love this. So at ACSM, Lauren Fleshman gave a talk, and it's actually really hard, I feel like, to step into ACSM as not necessarily a set expert in the field of science. So she's an expert in terms of communicating science, but she hasn't necessarily done the science. Yeah. And so she presented last on a panel of four speakers, and they all had like really set PowerPoint structures.
Yeah.
And she went up and she delivered this outstanding talk without a PowerPoint, just, you know, off the top of her head, or, you know, I'm sure she had it structured out, but it's really hard to do that. Like, transitioning from, like, we're having this like set presentation structure and then transitioning into your own is hard. But one of the main theses of her talk, which I loved, was on the power of people pleasing and how athletes that fall into people pleasing may be at higher risk of injury or low energy availability.
Interesting.
And how that works in terms of the coach athlete dynamic and how you can dispel that with like how you coach or even just like how you have open communication with athletes.
So what are your takeaways? Because like people pleasing is part of both of our natures, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially mine, but also yours. And also like as coaches, we have to be aware that like the impulses of maybe our athletes to people please could have negative implications if we're not understanding those. So like, what are your takeaways?
Well, my takeaways are one, to just be really open and honest about that. And to have, like, if you see someone doing that in a relationship, just to be like, hey, I sense people pleasing going on and use that as a framework. But I think for me, it's to celebrate everything.
Yeah.
Because I think when people pleasing becomes a challenge, it's when it's linked to some metric of performance. And so an athlete's trying to please you with their performance or with their amazing training run. And I get rid of that by just celebrating everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I celebrate the rest days, the cookie eating, the, you know, some of that stuff, which is like, you know, hard, but it's, I celebrate that in the same way as really big performances.
Unconditional celebration.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is the way to get around that. I like that a lot. I mean, it'll be relevant to a study we're going to get to in a few minutes.
How do you do it? Yeah.
I mean, same way. I mean, I celebrate everything. It's not something I honestly think about that much. I just give athletes accountability, I hope, to understand that like, I will not reward doing too much or going too hard just because it looks better on Strava. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been the bad guy a lot of being like, no, fuck this. Like, this is not okay. Even if this is something you want me to celebrate you.
Yes.
For.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the big point, is like actually having rules that you don't bend so that as a coach, you don't want to be the people pleaser. Because I think that's probably where you start to see a lot of issues, where there's a people pleasing athlete or whatever. And then the mentor coach, whatever, in any field, also wants to please that athlete. Mm-hmm. And it's this cycle where it's like a, you know, mutually assured destruction.
It's pleasing jerk off.
Yeah, yeah. It's a circle jerk of people pleasing. But yeah, so like basically that I'm not trying to hide a message.
Mm-hmm. And, yep. I love that. Yes.
You know, just being incredibly direct. I mean, almost to a fault, I think I'm direct. And probably my athletes have stories. In fact, I was on Free Trails office hours last week and Katie Asmuth shared some stories of how direct I was when we started out. And it made me cringe knowing how like trustworthy and incredible Katie is like as a human. But back then I didn't know. And I was just like, Katie, you know, if you, this is not okay. Like you can't, like if we're just coaching to this 100-miler, the incentives are wrong and I'm not going to do it and we can't do this anymore. And this was back in 2017 when Katie didn't, she said she wasn't really a runner back then. And so I think I've kind of applied that over time.
I love that. And I think for me too, it's athletes being flexible. Like if they hit 100% of the training plan, that's actually a red flag in my mindset, because like true athletes need to deviate from time to time. And so, yes, there are genetic freaks that can hit 100% of a training plan, but as a coach athlete, we need to make sure we're flexible, but the research supports this. So I actually loved, Rich Willey, who's a PT in Montana, gave a talk and he actually, during his talk, he put up an athlete's de-identified Strava profile that showed them going from like 56 miles a week to 102 miles a week. And then all of a sudden it went to zero.
Yeah.
And this was in a conversation on bone stress injuries. And I turned to the person sitting next to me and I was like, that's Adam Peterguard Strava. And it was kind of embarrassing. I said that with full confidence. It was one of those moments that I was like, you know, Megan, I might be in too deep. I might know this running world way too well.
This reminds me of Psalm 41. Because you're in too deep and
you're trying to keep.
Yeah. Now, I think if you know Adam Peterman's Strava file when it doesn't have a name on it, Megan, we might have to have an intervention there.
Yeah. What do you know? And I pulled it up and it was his Strava file.
Yeah.
But he recently suffered a sacral stress fracture, which is really sad. He's been open about it on Instagram. Actually, Jim Walmsley is out of world. So we really need to bubble wrap Killian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Keep our goats safe.
Keep our goats safe. Yes. Courtney, where are you? We need to protect you at all costs.
Very, very important.
It's kind of like Saving Private Ryan where like, you know, a few of the brothers didn't make it. And then they sent in everyone to protect one brother. That's what we need to do with Killian. All of us go and just protect Killian right now because Jim and Adam are currently hurt.
We're on a mission. I don't know. I don't think Killian's been hurt too often unless he's had like a traumatic break or something.
Yeah, I don't really think so. I mean, I don't know. I don't know him quite as well as you know Adam, which seems to be biblically.
I know. It's a little bit scary. But anyway, so Rich Willey in his talk presented this amazing article that I love that's actually from 2013. Yeah. And it's in the military. So I think this is probably why I haven't come across it before in bone stress injury research. But it was called Physical and Psychological Stressors Linked with Stress Fractures in Military Recruit Training. And this was in the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports.
Also, that journal steps the fuck up. It is one of the best journals in the world.
I agree, yeah.
I'm like, Scandinavia, man. Why is it's kind of odd that like a little geographic journal is putting out all of this amazing research. Like they're the ones that have published a lot of the great training intensity distribution stuff we've talked about.
Yeah, Scandinavia, man.
They're the new Canadians.
Oh, no. No one can be the new Canadians.
No, no, Megan.
Don't touch Canada.
We're inviting them all into our hot tub. In fact, I think that there's probably some synergy between Canada and Scandinavia.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, they're probably all in the same hot tub together. Yeah. I agree on that. But what they found was that there was a significant difference in the stress fracture group and the non-stress fracture group and how they perceived that their commander evaluated the performance.
Interesting.
So the hypothesis from the study was that the stress fracture group thought that their commander valued them highly, and this may have caused them to work harder to prove that they deserve this appraisal.
Interesting.
And so they were going above and beyond in training the stress fracture group to please their commander. And that was part of the theory as to why they might be fracturing more, is that they were adding things on as this like metric of people pleasing.
Interesting. Well, I mean, the conclusions from that are very fascinating because you put it in the military and like commanders or like, you know, drill sergeants or whatever are known to be assholes, right?
Yes,
You know, publicly. And maybe the assholes almost demotivate to the point that you're not getting injured.
Mm-hmm.
But that demotivation, when you're not in a setting that is mandatory, is probably not a productive thing either. Because like, you know, how is an athlete going to train enough to progress if they're being demotivated?
Exactly.
So what we might actually be measuring here is something different. We might be measuring motivation.
Agreed.
From someone that is highly valuing performance rather than, you know, them causing them to push athletes push themselves to injury. Like,
I think it's an important point to measure though, because I think as a coach, if you're sensing that level of motivation, you have to have a really upfront conversation with your athlete about, hey, this motivation is great. The flip side of this motivation may be something that's actually, you know, challenging.
And it could especially be challenging in context in athletics where you sometimes have mixed neural patterns being applied to running. Like last week we talked about neural circuits and habit formation, eating disorders. A lot of those times, those same neural circuits of those same athletes, when applied to running, can look very similar to the approach to food in the sense of like, you know, overdoing it or like pushing it or whatever. It's like just very black and white approaches. And probably being able to see that as a coach is really important.
And the challenge is sometimes those work.
Yeah.
And sometimes they work definitely really, really well until they don't.
Similar, like, you know, a lot of the best athletes in ultra running have had alcohol addiction, right?
Yep.
And yeah, it's because you can apply the same type of brain patterns to running with success, but often those athletes will have less long-term success for the same reasons, that it's just not sustainable because it's not coming from like a purely healthy spot.
Exactly. I think the answer to all of this is just throw some therapy on it.
Throw some therapy on it.
Yeah.
That's so perfect. Yeah. And actually one final thing on ACSM that I wanted to mention is the poster champion. I don't know exactly. They crown a poster champion.
The abstract champion. Yeah.
The abstract champion. Sorry.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So
it's a lot like mathletes. It's really interesting that you get a medal for this too.
I like it. It's so good.
You should really stand on a podium.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of like, I don't know, a beauty pageant or something.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to think of a way to not make that thought misogynistic. Couldn't tag the joke without it being sounding misogynistic, which is probably a bad sign for beauty pageants. They shouldn't exist. But what it did is it took Boston Marathon participants, something like 1,000 of them, and did a questionnaire that evaluated low energy availability risk, mm-hmm, so underfueling. And interestingly, what it found is that athletes that measured as more low energy availability risk, both men and women, performed worse, so had worse times. So, you know, it puts out that whatever, you know, myths you've heard about like controlling your body and stuff like that leading to better performance don't actually exist in a cross-population scale, but then also had a bigger risk of negative medical outcomes during the race itself. So it probably also points out that underfueling puts your body at extreme, like in a tenuous spot. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're more vulnerable to everything.
I love that study. It's from Kristen Whitney, actually out of Harvard. Yeah. She's a great researcher. So it was fun to see that. And she won a medal. It was great for low energy availability. What I liked, actually, I saw that presentation. She did a great job presenting it. Is she also used problematic low energy availability?
Interesting.
To talk about low energy availability. And I've been seeing that term more and more used because I think low energy availability can also be confusing in the sense that like we all sometimes have periods of low energy availability in our lives. And it's truly the problematic periods that are harder.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's talk about another study. This one came out in 2019 in the European Journal of Sports Science. It kind of puts a bow on all of this, on social factors and neurobiological pathways. The title is this, and it's really, really provocative. You don't need to administer a placebo to elicit a placebo effect. Social factors trigger neurobiological pathways to enhance sports performance.
I love this title. And I love talking about the placebo with you because you're the ultimate responder to the placebo and the ultimate placebo giver.
Well, my favorite thing is when I mentioned just the title to you this weekend, you said, oh, so it's the study on David Roach.
Yes. But now it's actually, we're going to get to the paper. It could also be the study using David Roach.
That's what I meant. I thought you meant me as the coach.
Well, it also talks about the placebo effect too. So you're both very prone to the placebo effect and you're also very good at giving the placebo effect.
Yeah. So the placebo effect is traditionally known as a positive outcome resulting from a person's belief that an inert substance is in fact an active drug. And what this looks at is that social factors are actually placebo effect too. That makes sense. We've talked about how self-talk improves performance by the same amount as an inert drug does that you're told helps. But this can also work in the different groups that you're aligned with, particularly coaching. And so the fascinating first line of the paper is this. The performance director of a UK Olympic team was recently described by one of his sports science support staff as a, quote, human placebo. This statement was qualified by a description of how the person in question always brings out the best performances from the athletes, often through social as opposed to technical processes.
And this was David Roach. No, just kidding. It was Ted Lasso and David Roach. Ted Lasso only in seasons 1 and season 2.
Yeah.
Season 3, we struggled to watch.
We stepped off the Ted Lasso bandwagon. We might get back to like...
We stepped in front of a Ted Lasso bus. Saying.
I don't know. I just was like, yeah. I mean, hopefully it's not a sign to the podcast that season 1, season 2, good. Season 3, I don't know.
We got to believe, man.
And we got to believe. I'm sure it gets great, but we just needed to...
No, we need to believe in ourselves, not Ted Lasso. We don't need to watch season 3.
But maybe that is actually relevant, though, to this.
Yeah.
In a very specific way. Because the story of Ted Lasso, as I understand it, is that the showrunner was Bill Lawrence, or like he was heavily involved in the show. He's the guy that did Scrubs. He moved over to Shrinking, a show we very much recommend on Apple Plus. Is fantastic. But he wasn't a big part of season 3 of Ted Lasso. And you can totally sense a vibe shift. And it points out how like the person that is providing perhaps some of the social structure, can change the way outputs happen in those settings too, which makes more sense in the writing room rather than performance. But I think in performance, any coach will tell you that, like, yeah, the point of motivation is just to get an athlete to believe in themselves so they can get that extra 1% every day that they wouldn't get otherwise. Because if you stack that up, it actually becomes physiology. And what seems like a placebo effect becomes your VO2 max or your lactate threshold or whatever. And that's the exciting part, I think, about this type of study.
And I would argue that it's probably even more than 1%. Yeah. It depends on the athlete, depends on where they're starting, depends on their baseline context. But this study I thought was really interesting because they actually compared some of it to similar brain pathways as opioids.
Yeah.
And I love this because somewhere out there, like, you're just giving out your David Roach positivity opioids. It's probably what someone in our car is doing too.
So true. And it even has like evolutionary causes. So in places with resource abundance, that's essentially what this is signaling, that you have resource abundance and relative safety. You're not being chased by a lion. You have plenty of fuel. You have plenty of everything.
Which is interesting that not being chased by a lion is actually a benefit of performance.
Oh, definitely long term, because you're not like, you know, those types of things that might cause immediate performance benefits also cause probably long term decrements. And so be aware of that, that safety, that support, that all of these things are what you want in your mentors and how you treat people too. So like this weekend on Saturday, we did a tempo run together. So Megan started before me, but right before she went off, she just looked at me right in the eyes and was like, "You got this." And she knew exactly what I needed to hear. And then when I passed her, you said some comment that was really uplifting. I could barely hear it because my ears were popping from the exertion.
It said something about you being sexy.
Yeah.
You were wearing very minimal amounts of clothing in the rain.
And that was kind of how I was approaching this weekend in general. It's like, when in doubt, wear nothing. And it gives you motivation. If nothing else, because you're running away from hypothermia. But the same thing, like, it brought more out in me than I had in myself. Mm-hmm. So think about your social pressures. Think about how you do this for others, not just in athletics, but also in life. You want all of this to be mutual success, caring about it together, bring that shared focus on growth, and so much more is possible. Like, we are lifted up when we open ourselves to others.
And I think communicate that too. Yeah. So just the other weekend, so a week ago, we did a run together and you kept making comments on my form. Yeah. And I should be a coachable athlete. I should be able to internalize that. But for whatever reason, I rebelled.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want to hear comments about my form, yada, yada, yada. And I told you.
And it's complicated because think about the last study. Or the other studies where you're like, there need to be hardcore rules that you're actually applying.
Yes, yeah.
To avoid an athlete injuring themselves and causing stress fracture.
But the point is, we can talk about it after the run. Like, yeah. I feel like for me, iterating those form cues every single mile is overload for my brain.
And I did great this weekend.
Exactly. But that's my point, is that, like, I felt like we had that communication. Yeah. And it was just this atmosphere of love and good vibes. And it was the best. And we both had great runs.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We wouldn't have had a great run if your pelvis was broken in too, though.
But it didn't.
It didn't. It all worked out.
Well, I knew what I was doing.
Yeah. Okay. Just like those military recruits, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Same exact thing. And so final thing here is that, like, I think every coach and expert should think about how to provide security and stability as much as possible to the athlete.
Every leader, yeah.
Thinking about the evolutionary reasons here. Like, those are the things where people thrive. And I, you know, I remember my dad growing up, like, he is the original Coach Roach. He knew nothing about these sports really. I mean, he was a fan, but he created a team of little champions because he just kept giving us a shot. And the example I always remember is there was one kid in our baseball team who could not hit the ball for his life. And my dad stood there and just threw the ball in front of, and, you know, we were in like middle school at this point, so pretty far along. It was like 3 feet away from him, which is dangerous as fuck. And just threw the ball over and over until my dad hit his bat. And then in one of the playoff games, we only had 9 players on our team. The same kid came up, he basically struck out or walked in every single at bat he did. And he hit a double that won the game. And, you know, I just think that that type of point, it all comes down to, like, having someone that believes in you so much that you can eventually learn that it's okay to believe in yourself.
And I feel like that safety is fundamental for a belief environment, like an environment of believing in yourself. So for me, it was my high school coach, Karen.
Yeah.
And she was actually at my sister's wedding, and Leo got to meet her. And it was curious to me because he fell asleep in her arms within 5 minutes. And I think it goes to show, like, what type of environment
that's
she created as a high schooler, where it was this environment of, like, fun and self-belief, but also safety too. And Leo definitely felt that because he was like, I'm gonna go to sleep.
Yeah. Also, her and I got to talk for a while when you were, I think you were dancing or something.
I was definitely dancing.
You were definitely dancing. You were definitely, like, doing the stanky leg out there. And I got to hear Megan's stories about how much you dominated bitches. And even now, like, her belief in you shines through so much. And I think that's what we all need.
I love Karen.
I love Karen too. She's great. Okay. Do you want to talk about iron?
Let's do it. Actually, let's do it briefly. Cause yes. I think, this was also at the ACSM conference, and I don't know, I get asked all the time by athletes about iron recommendations, and I feel like the literature has changed constantly on this. I have changed constantly on this, and I'm going to come down with an official statement as to how to supplement iron, which is rare.
So drum roll, please. This is Megan's official statement.
No. And this is based off of newer research. There was a poster at ACSM out of Australia called Iron Absorption in Highly Trained Runners. Does when and where you eat it matter?
Interesting.
And I liked how they said eat it, but I guess you could also eat iron pills too, because the primary way I get iron is by swallowing iron pills.
When in doubt, eat it.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the lesson here.
Just munch it.
just munch it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just slurp it.
Just toss that salad.
Yeah, exactly. But what they found was that, so what we know is that hepcidin is a regulator of iron metabolism. Hepcidin actually inhibits iron transport, and it does this, it binds to the iron export channel, which is called ferroportin. So hepcidin is really heavily involved in iron metabolism. And so when we're thinking about when to take iron, we want to think about hepcidin levels and when they're at their lowest. Yeah. That way we can absorb the iron. And generally in the mornings is when hepcidin is at its lowest. And often if you're a morning exerciser, you can often get in this window 30 minutes post-exercise.
Yes.
So for me, I've been starting to take iron 30 minutes post-exercise, and I think it's probably the best time to take iron, unless you can take it first thing in the morning, but sometimes it's hard to take it in exercise.
Is that counted at all by like inflammation from exercise?
Yeah, that's why I've been going back and forth on this, because I used to say like, okay, 4 to 6 hours after exercise, away from like coffee and calcium and these other things that bind iron and or interfere with iron transport.
Yeah.
But because of thinking of the inflammation. So I've been seesawing on this, but I do like the morning.
Megan, we were looking for a definitive statement.
I know, and I'm back to seesawing.
That's not okay.
Yeah.
No, we need to express our fluids fully. And I'm going to be serious here, which is I recommend this to every athlete. Take your iron and your primary supplements that don't involve magnesium or calcium, which can affect iron absorption, directly after exercise if you're an AM exerciser.
Yep.
With a ton of hydration. I've seen that those lead to the best numbers. With myself, I've seen it lead to the best numbers. It is a window when you can absorb better. And I think that more and more, we're going to see studies that come out that find that those are the people that have best results. And I think that there's some benefit for your stomach, because if you ever have stomach issues on the run, sometimes supplements can cause that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you don't want to take it early morning if you're training right after, for most people. But having more time before your next main session can help. So like if you have it right after a run, it might be 22 hours before your next activity. So it'll give your body more time to process it. So we're officially team post run. Is that okay?
Yeah, I like that. It's also, we're team morning. Yeah. We're team morning in life. And this kind of our, I feel like our iron philosophy is now evolving with that.
And if you're a PM runner, probably just take it in the morning.
Yeah, I agree. I think that duration of time is probably fine.
As long as it doesn't make you farty.
Yeah.
I guess you got to pay attention to that.
I've also anecdotally, this is like very, very anecdotal. I've heard that some athletes that take iron at night struggle with sleep afterwards. Which I don't know if there's like an exact mechanism for that, but I've seen it enough anecdotally that I'm going to comment on it.
You just feel the red blood cells being created.
Yeah, you feel the duende in your body.
Yeah, and a broader statement about the importance of iron. A study just came out in Current Psychiatry that was on iron deficiency in psychiatric patients. We're not going to get into the details here, but essentially what they found is that patients dealing with worse psychiatric issues had a much lower rate of just much lower iron levels, usually, across a bunch of different studies. And it points out that this isn't just athletics. Like, your iron levels are incredibly important to everything you do. And the levels we want to see in general are 40 plus on ferritin, and also corresponding higher hemoglobin numbers, though that is a lot more variable day to day. So get your blood tested, check your ferritin, make sure it's over 40, and ideally even higher. Like, I got my blood tested, it was 26, which is so low, but I always assumed it was going to be higher. And since I've started taking iron, I felt so much better. Also better mentally, even though, you know, I probably wouldn't be captured by this study unless there's something I'm not considering.
Well, I was skeptical about the study because if you think about the line of causation of iron, individuals with mental health illnesses probably have more challenges with nutrition. And so they're not absorbing iron. Sometimes like overall physical health is impaired, thus their iron would be lower. So I was like, okay, like what is the actual line of causation? But when you dig into a little bit deeper, actually, they show that iron deficiency may actually alter dopamine in the brain. So I was like, okay, that's like a plausible biological underpinning to this.
Yeah.
And then they've also shown that individuals that have iron deficiency without anemia actually do see an improvement in their psychiatric symptoms with iron treatment, even though it's not leading to impacts on like impacts in terms of like lower than normal hemoglobin levels. Yeah.
I mean, iron is just so important. I'm reading right now Tyler Hamilton's book, The Secret Race. Mainly recommend Molly Shannon's book. But after that, if you haven't read this book, it came out in 2012, read it. It's fascinating. I'm actually listening to it, and it's really well done. But all of their doping that they did back in the Pro Peloton was designed to raise hematocrit. And hematocrit is heavily dependent on your iron stores. So like, you know, the evil shit that they did back then, or like the unethical stuff that they did back then, was essentially just saying like, okay, we've optimized this, let's optimize more. But the first step for everyone in thinking about your performance that will also affect your mental health, that will also probably make you like a happier, more well-rounded person, is get that iron level up or to a healthy levels.
I love it.
Like, you know, Thorn Iron Bisglycinate is my favorite. Megan likes...
I like Nature Made.
Nature Made 65 milligram iron. That's just her old go-to. But think about it. It is so helpful, especially if you've never gotten tested. Get tested now.
Okay. And the final point from ACSM, and this is literally going to be a two-minute summary of a broader three-hour poster session. So there was a poster session of 8 posters on the menstrual cycle. And all 8 of those posters found no significant finding in terms of athletes having impacted performance or other measures across the menstrual cycle, which tracks. And I feel like there's been so much like gimmicky menstrual cycle, cycle syncing apps and things along these lines. And I think what it's really showing is that when we think about the menstrual cycle, we need to think about the individual differences. Like there's individual data points. Like I coach 3 or 4 athletes that are heavily affected by the menstrual cycle. Yeah. But if you look at the broader population of my athletes, it's not going to be significant. So I think individually on the menstrual cycle as opposed to like broad cycle syncing or changes in your menstrual cycle based off of an app.
But you can contrast that with last week.
I know.
We're on the podcast. Yeah. And like you were able to train fine, but your performance, like in terms of your self-love.
My self-judgment was shit.
Yeah, it was pretty shit. And that could affect running performance
too. Oh, it absolutely will because.
So you might end up after pregnancy being one of those women that needs to think a little bit about PMS in terms of workout timing.
And certain people do. But I also think that's a curious point because I think athletes that are just like, I'm reestablishing my menstrual cycle postpartum. Yeah. So for me, I think the impact of the hormones are higher. But I think the same goes for someone who's like reestablishing a menstrual cycle after low energy availability or an adolescent athlete. My body is like hormones. What are these?
Well, I mean, it's so interesting. And like, so essentially the research is saying every single person is different. And across the population, there is no reason to make alterations to your training around it.
But on the individual level,
there definitely could be. So just listen to your body and don't listen to gimmicks. let's do a quick rundown. Then we'll probably be right to hot takes. We've had a lot of fun today.
This has been fun.
It's been so fun.
Yeah. It's a good 3-year anniversary.
Yeah. Okay. So first one is precision nutrition hydration. This is embarrassing. Last week we shared a discount code with you and it was the wrong code.
Actually, you shared the discount. I'm just going to point a finger right here. You shared the wrong code.
So precision, it's absolutely magical shit. Listen to last week, but the code is SWAP15, SWAP15.
We forgot the 15.
Oh my God. So you're going to get 15% off. Use it there. Here's an email from a listener. I try precision gel out today on my run. The absolute best. I usually don't eat before and during my runs. I tend towards the low-carb/keto side of eating, which I'm trying to break free from. Ugh, not always easy. I'm so thankful to you and Megan for bringing up the topic of eating so much and how we need to fuel our runs before, during, and after. I've started drinking protein and carb drink before and ending my run with a protein carb drink. Today, I talked myself into having precision gel. Wow, the flavor is perfect. It's so neutral. And I finished my run so much stronger than I have for a while. Thank you so much for recommending them and the discount also. I appreciate your being so real with no pretense.
This listener is great. Yeah. I also think we should do advertisements for anyone who does low carb keto.
Yeah.
Because when they have precision, they're going to feel so good.
Oh my God.
They're going to feel turbocharged. Yeah.
SWAT 15, use that code. It is fucking magical gel. And you know, we're not sure how long this partnership is going to last. So please get that discount soon. It'll help so much.
And I loved your Strava title this week. So you had a great Strava title that was, my self-belief is optimized at 120 grams of carbohydrates per hour.
That's so true for me though.
Yeah.
So I've learned over time that like, I believe in myself so much.
Even when you're on your period?
Yeah. Seriously though. I mean, if it's most evident when I'm biking or doing long runs, but if I fuel a lot, I maintain a positive mental outlook so much better. And even if I fuel like a small amount, it's a little better, but not nearly that much. So if you have issues with like long distance events, please just go extreme carb heavy. It doesn't have to be precision though, probably for the best because it tastes fucking awesome. 2 quick follow-ups on the podcast last week. The first, Glute Bridges, someone in the UK sent me. They might be punking me. I'm not sure if this is true. The glute bridges there are called sky humpers.
That's amazing. I would do so much more strength if I was sky humping.
Yeah.
Well, I believe it because in the UK, bonking is actually just banging.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah. So we're not sure if this is true. I hope it's true. So you have sky humpers, which are glute bridges when you thrust up to the sky. And then I imagine that ground humpers would be like child's pose, or not child's pose, cobra pose in yoga. You could just call that ground humping.
Oh, I love that. Well, we're on a new podcast outline in terms of like our running Google Doc.
Yeah.
We started it today, but we ended the last one. You just wrote in all caps on our podcast outline, sky humpers.
Sky humpers.
And it's such a good way for that outline. It's got like 400 pages.
Yeah.
Such a good way for it to go
out.
Gotta
end on sky humpers.
We should just write it on, there should be our license plate on our car.
Yeah.
Sky humpers.
Oh my God.
It's going to get stolen so fast.
Sky hump.
Yeah.
Simply that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Let's I bet it. You no one in Colorado has that.
And you won't be able to steal our car because it'll be very identifiable. That and the T-Rex. Number two, we talked about the neural circuits last week. A listener wrote in and talked about a lot of recent trials that are being undertaken, particularly at Cal Berkeley and Johns Hopkins, on this particular neural circuit that we talked about and the use of psychedelic therapy. So a lot of this is still, you know, undergoing, but I've seen in coaching that psychedelic therapy for things like, you know, severe eating disorders, long-term severe type depression, hypomania, bipolar disorder, and PTSD can be relatively game-changing.
Agreed, yeah.
So we just want to throw it out there, not a place where we're experts, but if you're dealing with something, try to explore psychedelic therapy through legal methods, so we don't advocate anything negative. Like, this is something that is actually scientific, but consider it because it can disrupt neural circuits that have led to unhealthy places and sometimes like very unhappy places.
Wow, that was a lot. I'm glad we're 65 minutes into this podcast when you're like, just do psychedelics.
No, I'm not
just
saying,
try them.
I'm saying psychedelic therapy, assisted therapy.
Like, yes, yeah. I mean, you know, I think it does have a lot of benefits.
And the studies are unguided. Like, you know, if you're just taking recreational mushrooms, you're going to get what you carry into it, which sometimes is very negative from what I understand. So
our official podcast stands 5 minutes in its cookies.
Yeah.
And 65 minutes in its psychedelics, assisted therapy and cookies.
I've never done psychedelics. So
not even either.
That being said, a lot of the people I love have, and I've seen people, especially dealing with PTSD, like after they've been in Desert Storm or been in, you know, the more recent Iraq war or Afghanistan or whatever, I've seen pretty incredible things. Okay. Then maybe the last little thing to talk about here is we wanted to give a shout out to Faith Kip Yegon.
What a world record she just had. That was incredible.
We talk a lot about like pregnancy and things. So she had a kid in 2018, took 18 months off. And then just set the world record in 1500 meters. She ran a 3:49, which is essentially equivalent to like a 4:06 mile,
That's
I think.
Bonkers fast.
God, women are going so fast. Just remarkable. But it points out that if you're out there, you're going through any longer term setback, whether that's, you know, an injury or pregnancy or whatever, I think take solace in someone like Faith Kip Yegon coming back stronger than ever and know that your body is capable of miraculous things, even if you don't feel like it in the moment.
It was so cool. And her long-term history tracks up. And she was a junior champion.
Yeah.
She was running barefoot in some of her early championships, which is wild. Isn't her biomechanics cool? Must be so good.
Yeah, just remarkably fun. So go Faith Kip Yegon. And if you are someone that's on the parenting journey, you get a lot of fun little things. I was just thinking about this. Last week I did a couple doubles with Leo since he can now go in the jogging stroller, as we talked about.
It's so much fun to have him in the jogging stroller. And I was a little bit honored about our stroller pushing and running abilities because my mom saw the video of Leo running, us running with Leo in the jogging stroller, and she sent us a helmet.
Yeah.
She sent us a helmet. She did actually an Amazon Prime order within 3 hours of the helmet because she was like, he must have a helmet for these expeditions.
I'm never going to put that helmet on him.
Oh no. Yeah.
We need to look cool out there.
Yeah. Right.
No, we're like in the 2002 Tour de France or whatever, where they would just take off their helmets on the climbs. That's what we're like. But with Leo.
I was like, Mom, how fast do you think we're running?
But I was out there doing little doubles with him. Finally, a baby that wants to double at my pace, which is I like to double a few minutes per mile slower than my normal run. Like I'll double at 10 or 11 minutes per mile.
He does fall asleep a little more on your doubles.
Yeah. But I've never been able to find anyone who wants to run my double pace. And he does. But I learned, so we talked about last week using Moana. This week I used our SWAT playlist, Love and Kindness and Hill Strides. Check it out on Spotify. And as I'm passing our neighbors, what's blaring but backseat windows up. That's the way I like to fuck. And Leo's just there like smiling at our neighbors. And so our entire neighbors think we're very good at doubling and I have very questionable tastes in raising a child.
What's your fantasy's great taste in raising a child?
That's true.
We should really have an Elmo. What's your fantasy?
Oh.
You also don't love Elmo either.
No. Nothing about Elmo makes me feel comfortable or safe or loved or secured. He's the opposite of one of those motivational figures for me.
Meanwhile, I hear Elmo's happy, happy dance, and I get pumped as pumped as Leo does. And you're over there like, no.
I'm just like, you should probably sign up for a watch list and not be within 300 meters of schools, Elmo. Okay, so before we get to hot takes, a very quick shout out for an amazing queer running group that is just forming in Santa Cruz, California. This is more of a general statement about Happy Pride to start the month.
And do you know who just wished people happy pride?
Who?
Elmo.
Oh.
There was a whole Pride episode on Elmo. I'm like, David, can't you see? Elmo's intentions are good.
Elmo's on my good side now.
That's how we win you over as Rainbow Flex.
Yes. You give me a rainbow flag and I'm a very happy man. but this is an email from a listener. I just wanted to let you know about a cool little something I cooked up recently. I started a queer trail running club for the Santa Cruz area, and we were having our first meetup slash run on Sunday the 11th. I started it because I realized there weren't a lot of safe outdoor-oriented spaces for queer folks like me, and that weren't centralized around alcohol. I was also super duper inspired by the amazing Ryan Montgomery starting a queer trail running club in Salt Lake City. So the Instagram for this group is queer_trail_run_club. If you just write queer trail running, I think you can find it on Instagram. They're meeting on the 11th. If you're in the Santa Cruz area, go check it out. This is also for allies. This is not just for queer people. But we also want to just celebrate this generally and to understand that like running is the space for openness, love, full support, and inclusion. And so if you're out there, you know, do stuff like this if you can. It's so cool. But also know that wherever you're coming from, you are represented and you're cared for.
It's so amazing to see running becoming like more and more an inclusive environment by the day. I mean, I think there's still pockets where it's a struggle.
Definitely.
But this makes me so happy. Also, if you're not in Santa Cruz, go to Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
We love Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz is the best.
And I would actually move there if we didn't live in Boulder.
Somehow it just got even better because of this queer trail running group.
Exactly.
Which I didn't think was possible. Okay, let's get on to hot takes. People love the hot takes. Our podcast numbers have taken off since it has started. People are just listening to the hot takes sometimes, which makes me pretty proud.
That's exciting.
Okay, so the first one, HRV, heart rate variability, is bullshit.
Yeah, I agree. We're 75 minutes in, so I'm just going to add, it's fucking bullshit.
Yeah, well, I mean,
you can just listen. If we just had resting heart rate,
yeah,
I think we'd actually do a better job than HRV.
That's my problem. I think HRV does represent a lot, but I think sometimes it depends so heavily on how it's measured and where exactly you're at in sleep cycles or whatever, that you're getting a lot of noise and less signal than people make it out to be. So I like HRV in the sense that like it's a good data point. But do I think you should be planning your training based on HRV? And the answer is a strong no, especially if you have resting heart rate. Because if you have resting heart rate, you know, you're a great example. Your resting heart rate today was really low, which means you're feeling good and recovered. For me, 1 or 2 beats per minute in resting heart rate is a huge signal. Meanwhile, I see swings in HRV all the time and I'm like, I don't know what the fuck that is. Was that an email that was stressful? Was that training? Is that something I should listen to? I don't know. But I'm a little down on HRV as an athletic driver. I like it as a general tool though.
Do you know what I'm up on as a general tool? What? Is basal body temperature tracking for female athletes.
Whoa.
I think it's a really helpful marker of ovulation and where you are in your cycle.
Where's the thermometer go?
Actually, it can go on your...
That was a good noise.
I was going to make a joke. That's the noise that you make when something goes up your butt. Okay. No, I'm just kidding.
That's so good.
You can track it very easily. They have armbands.
Okay, you can have
rings. There's other metrics. Yeah. But you can get really accurate in other places.
You're so funny. I love you so much. Interesting, though. So it's measuring menstrual cycle type things.
Measuring ovulation, which can be helpful. I mean, I think for me, it can be helpful for predicting when I'm going to have a day of 3 hours of crying in this new postpartum phase. But yeah.
And maybe the menstrual cycle thing is a great lesson for HRV too. Chart where the numbers are over time. Like it's good to know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Make sure that it actually is a driver for you though.
Yeah.
Right? Like cross-population associations might not be N=1 associations. So for me, resting heart rate definitely is a signal.
Oh yeah. I think it is for a lot of athletes. Yeah.
HRV within moderate, like unless I'm 2 or 3 standard deviations difference, I'm not noticing any necessary change. That being said, it is a helpful thing for me to understand long-term trends. Like if I'm having too much stress and need to take an easy week or a few rest days or something.
I love that.
Okay, next one. Seems like every day I'll see Strava titles like completely fasted, did this on no water, 24 hours without food, no carbs in 15 centuries, as if to say that doing workouts in this way is somehow superior. Most often it's from male athletes. Hot take, this isn't the flex you think it is.
I think we're going to flex in the opposite direction and so show our supreme GI strength.
Yeah.
I did this workout on 24 cookies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you saw my 120 grams of carbs per hour Strava title last week.
Well, you're going to be 120.75 grams of carbs per hour, so that it's not a complete number.
Exactly. And I think this is a really fascinating point and really important in that often you do see this type of machismo bragging about restricting from bodies. I think less so and less so over time, but like there is no honor in that, right?
Agreed.
Like that is almost never going to be associated with positive neural circuits. And if you dug down deep enough, you'd almost always find that. It's fine for people to do that if it's what they draw meaning from, but never, ever, ever let it infect your own approach. Like the reason we talk about fueling is that it's the only way to perform. Every single scientific study backs that up. And sometimes it can seem sciencey, especially bro sciencey, when you hear some of these things, But if you actually dig down into the data, it's almost always a whole crock of bullshit.
Okay, mic drop. Yeah. That was a whole crock of bone broth drop right there. That was real good.
Dude, why are you so good?
I'm not.
Okay, you're so good. Okay, next one. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. KT tape? I think it really helped me nurse a foot injury, blah, blah, blah. And later on, I had toe issues, and I repaired it with KT tape. My hot take is that KT tape is the best. And I agree with this one, actually. Taping things can be magical. I don't understand it. Is it placebo? I'm thinking that it's like security, almost like one of those coaches that makes you feel safe. But whenever I put KT tape on something, I feel like 97% better.
Which you do a lot. You have like you have a very minimal approach to clothing. You basically run in underwear, and then the rest of you is just taped up like a hot dog.
Oh, it's so fun. You should try it out there. Okay, so a main place that I think it can help. Like, let's say your big toe hurts. Like, often this happens with athletes where they get a little bit of rubbing. It's unlikely to be a metatarsal issue. If you put a little bit of KT tape over there, never have to think about that motherfucker again. Similarly, your plantar hurts, just KT tape that thing. Your knee, KT tape. Your face, your mental health, just straight up into your brain. KT tape on fMRI.
Do you know what it's also great for?
What?
Waxing. We should just put it in your nose. Just wax your nose hairs with that as you rip it off.
Megan, you can't say that when you're looking at me with these unibrow.
That's just true. That's why we use KT tape in this house.
The pot is calling the kettle something over here.
But I actually KT tape my ankles when I try on. Yeah, it's very helpful.
Yeah, we're huge fans of ankle taping. Number four. Cats are far superior to dogs.
Yeah, hell no.
Yeah.
Definitely not. Cats want to eat us.
Yeah.
I mean, if they were bigger, it had like, they would totally eat us in the middle of the night, whereas dogs just want to snuggle.
So I think cats are much like some of these scientific studies. The cats come in a lot more variation than dogs. Like,
that's a good point. Yeah.
Your average dog is going to be a great experience. But like, some cats are the best creatures on the planet, and some cats are moderately evil.
Some cats are mountain lions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They're like small mountain lions. And so, you know, I do agree that a great cat can be great, but I also think this person should hang out with a golden retriever for just a day and see how that feels.
That's a good point. You had cats growing up. This is the viewpoint. I have never been around a cat. I'm actually very allergic to cats.
Yeah.
So this is also influencing my viewpoint too.
And also I actually heard from someone that, they like cats more than dogs because dogs, like, it's like a conditional love association with food. Mm-hmm. And so there's...
That's a good point. Addie just loves us for her cookies.
No, Addie loves us.
Yes, yeah.
I hope.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
But
she doesn't love Leo.
She doesn't love Leo yet. She's getting there.
Yeah, that's because Leo is pulling chunks of her fur out. Yeah. He's basically giving her Brazilian wax every time she walks around and she's very traumatized.
That's true. She's doing to him what I need to do to my hair.
With KT tape.
Yeah. And so... But cats, meanwhile, it's like you're earning all their love. So it's a very different type of social relationship. I'm much more of like a wanting a dog person because like I can't have anything conditional. I need that thing to just like be obsessed with me because.
Am I your golden retriever in life?
Oh my God, Megan, you're like.
That's how much I love you.
Yeah. I mean, you're like one of those Bernese mountain dogs.
You ever such an honor.
You ever see those?
I love, yeah.
And you're just like, oh my God, I've never hung out with you, dog, but I love you to the end of the earth and back. That's how I felt when I first met you.
If. For Addie too, which is going to happen eventually. Can we get a Bernese mountain dog?
Oh, when she dies? Is that what you're saying? You don't want to say it out loud?
Yeah, I struggle with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I say, we've talked about this before, but we clone Addie.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, just clone her.
Yeah. But I think actually proving the point about why dogs are better than cats, the price to clone a dog is double that of a cat. And it's the same scientific process. Yeah. So you see where the supply and demand is at.
Okay, I've changed my mind. What we do, we can clone. We can save her. Stuff for cloning, but then we taxidermy her, and her because at the Giro d'Italia, so at the big bike race, I saw someone that was running with their taxidermied. I believe it was their dog. It could have been a fox, but alongside the race. So what we can do then is go to running races, go to like Heartbreak Hill,
go to Western States Forest Hill,
and run alongside them with Addie taxidermied, like they did in the Giro d'Italia. That would be Addie's dream, and I think it would continue her spirit into the future.
Only if we can feed her precision hydration.
We're going to do psychedelics, precision hydration, run with Addie at Forest Hill beside the race.
Perfect.
Okay, let's go into listener corner. That's the best way to end it. Cool if I read this one?
Go for it.
Dear David and Megan, I started listening to your podcast after reading tens of articles from Trail Runner and finding out those that I loved most and made me laugh were authored by David. You can only imagine my joy when I discovered you have a podcast. It is the most wholesome hour a week in my podcast. Wholesome.
We've been called wholesome a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the compliment or just being like, no, you guys
like
are weird.
I like it. Wholesome usually associate with like Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, I know, but we're Little House on the Prairie that's just like banging.
Yeah, talking about fluids over here. Yeah. Actually, but we're pretty, it's a pretty long podcast, but we're pretty far along. We can say that before we started today, we did our little meditation where we put our hands out in that little like meditative pose, brought ourselves to center and then said, banging.
Actually, that's not what we said.
Oh, what did we say?
We said juice bot. It's true. You look at you with a revision. It's You're true. Just making us even more wholesome.
Ah, juice spot. So thank you for your wholesome comment. That makes me happy. Last Sunday, I ran my first marathon, and I'm incredibly proud of myself for getting the time I aim for and for all the work I've done in the past months. You were basically my running buddies, as I always saved your podcast for my runs, and you made my most sweaty tempo sessions much more bearable. This time, too, I saved an episode for my marathon, and you were there with me when I was going through the most mind-boggling experience in my life. The pain and tiredness made me want to stop, but this incredible willpower belief in my strength kept me going, something I hadn't thought I had in me. At some point, your talk about college and sounded like a word salad, and my tired brain could not comprehend what you were talking about, but listening to your familiar voices really helped me in this tough moment. For this, I want to thank you. I also want to thank you for how much emphasis you put on the necessity for radical self-acceptance and eating enough always. I struggled with my body image on this annoying low-key level that never made me think it was serious enough, but has been taking up a lot of my mental resources. A part of me still believes that if I lose 5 kilograms, it would make me faster and, quote, more athletic, or that maybe a marathon would hurt less. But having listened to your message over and over again, I'm closer to accepting my body and celebrating its abilities more than ever before. Thanks to you both for being so inspiring, positive, and funny. I cannot wait to train for my next race using one of your plans. Best of luck on all of your future endeavors, you beautiful people.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of this person and the journey they've been on.
Yeah. It's so cool. Yeah. I mean, first, hell yeah, the marathon.
Marathons That's so cool.
are so hard.
They are so hard. Road so marathons, hard. I would rather run 100K on trails than a road marathon.
100 miles yeah, for me. Like exactly. If I'm yeah. actually going for performance at this point in my life, like I truly think so. And another reminder, like celebrate yourself so wholeheartedly. But then one other thing I think is really interesting here is how they talked about getting to this point where they had willpower and belief in their strength to keep going, this incredible feeling in their bodies. And that's what I hope we can help just a little bit with, is that we're all on that journey. Mm-hmm. And that you don't need to get to the point that you feel like, you know, you're Jim Walmsley or Courtney DeWalter or something. But turning that notch up just like 0.02% on a daily basis can make such a fucking difference. Like, it's insane how much of a difference it can make in your whole life. And so running as a template for that willpower and belief is why it's meaningful. It's why we do this podcast every week. It's why we talk about training theory and go to conferences and work hard. So, you know, let's all try to do that just a little bit. And it takes courage, because I think a lot of our brains don't want us to. Like, it's almost fun to scratch the itch of self-judgment.
It takes courage and 3.75 cookies.
At least that many cookies. And then the final thing is just on the body, like that background programming that they mentioned is kind of similar to what I talked about with calorie counting. So I just want to say, you're out there, you're probably dealing with a background programming. Let's all try to just, when those thoughts come in, let them go out. And remember David and Megan over here saying, you are sexy, perfect wildebeests.
Yes. And as I think about your background programming, I'm thinking about screensavers.
Yeah.
You know how like those come on for background programming? Oh, I'm just thinking about like rotating through an entire epic photo roll of different things.
I like that. But you know the old ones that had the like little icon that bounced around?
Oh, yes. They were mesmerizing.
Yeah. And it would say like a DVD or something. Yeah. On it. What I'm imagining right now is one that's just traveling around and it's like G-spot. G-spot.
Oh, I thought I was going to say, you are amazing. Oh. You are amazing. You are amazing. But G-spot is much better.
Yeah, yeah. And each time it hits the edge, it just does a little moan. Oh. We love you all.
Woohoo.
Huzzah.